6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. U.S. Senate has voted decisively to approve a new package of stiff financial sanctions against Russia, Iran, and North Korea. Ben Cardin, a Democrat, is a U.S. senator from the state of Maryland.
It's a strong message that the United States Senate is united, that we will take tough action against Russia for their attack against the United States in our elections, for their interference in the sovereignty of countries in Europe, from Ukraine to Georgia to Moldova, to what they have done in Syria in supporting war crimes.
Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker also spoke to reporters at meeting, admitting that even though the bill is quite popular, President Trump might not necessarily favor it. Corker also noted he had been in discussions with Mr. Trump and other White House officials who did not indicate a veto would happen. Both the House and Senate votes are veto-proof, as the White House has wavered on whether the president would sign the measure into law. While the Trump administration is seeking a reason to keep American troops in Afghanistan after 16 years of war, U.S. officials are also examining options to stabilize conflicts in the region. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is not advocating, he says, any military options, but instead is pushing for talks. Israeli police and Palestinian worshippers clashed outside a revered holy site and the Old City within Jerusalem after Israel removed final elements of a security measure installed earlier this month. The clashes arose after Muslim leaders in Jerusalem gave permission for their worshippers to re-enter that site. This is VOA News. Iran says that it has successfully launched a rocket carrying a satellite into space, and state television in Tehran claimed the rocket is capable of carrying a 250-kilogram satellite as far as 500 kilometers above Earth. It did not elaborate on any payload that might have been on this rocket or that it could handle. Thursday's launch did not violate the 2015 nuclear agreement, which was signed by Iran and the P5+1 group of world powers. United Nations Security Council approving resolution encouraging Greek and Turkish Cypriots to sustain their commitment to reunifying the divided Mediterranean island. We get that story now from VOA's Doug Bernard.
Cyprus was divided into a Turkish-speaking north and a Greek-speaking south in 1974. That's when Turkey invaded the island following a coup aimed at unifying Cyprus with Greece. Reunification talks collapsed earlier this month, and the council welcomed progress made by leaders in both communities and urged them to focus their efforts on reaching agreement on outstanding issues. The resolution adopted by the council on Thursday extends the mandate of the UN peacekeeping force in Cyprus until January 31, 2018. It also asks Secretary General Antonio Guterres to conduct a strategic review of the mission within 4 months. Doug Bernard, VOA News.
Nationwide general strike in Venezuela continues on the streets, where 3 people in the last day or so have been killed in the ongoing showdown to protest the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Maduro has scheduled a vote for this Sunday for the assembly to restore order in Venezuela, where more than 100 people have been killed in almost daily violent clashes between protesters and security forces since April. Opposition leaders say Maduro intends to assume more authoritarian rule once an assembly is acceptable to him is chosen. Britain's Prince William is hanging up his flight suit for the last time. The heir to the British throne held his first and last overnight shift at the East Anglian Air Ambulance Service, where he had been flying medical crews and emergencies for nearly 2 years now. 35-year-old Duke of Cambridge is giving up his job to become a full-time royal. Job change also has to do with location. William and his wife, former Kate Middleton, will be spending less time at their Norfolk residence in favor of going back to London, where their 4-year-old son, Prince George, is about to start school. Get more news at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Some Ghanaians are calling for the resignation or impeachment of the Electoral Commission chair and two deputies.
It is important that while they are being investigated, they step aside and an interim chair appointed to work with the other members of the commission so that some stability and some kind of harmony could be restored for prisoner work to go on.
Emmanuel Akwete is the executive director of the Institute for Democratic Governance in Ghana. Gambia's interior minister denies bribery allegations. South Sudan's president appoints a committee to deal with acute fuel shortages. And Burundi's government responds to a UN call for inclusive dialogue.
I wanted to remind that the government has said that there's no way Burundi is going to sit together with people who have committed crime and who were planning a coup against the leaders of Burundi.
Alain Diomedi Nzeyimana is the deputy spokesman for Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. And a new report accuses Al-Shabaab of burning down homes in Somalia's lower Shabella region in late May of this year. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A cross-section of Ghanaians is calling for the resignation or impeachment of the country's Electoral Commission chairperson and two of her deputies. Chairperson Charlotte Osei had been accused by her deputies of incompetence, corruption, and low morale among senior staff. In rebuttal, the electoral chief accused the deputies of sabotage and corruption. Meanwhile, supporters of the ruling New Patriotic Party, NPP, have called for Osei's resignation. But partisans of the main opposition National Democratic Congress, the NDC, say the crisis was created by the ruling NPP to force the electoral chief to step down. Emmanuel Akwete, executive director of the Institute for Democratic Governance, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the chairperson and her two deputies should step aside to allow for an investigation to take place.
It is important that while they are being investigated or they are sorting out their issues, they step aside and an interim chair appointed to work with the other members of the commission so that some stability and some kind of harmony could be restored for prisoner work to go on.
Some are saying that politically she is compromised and that is why she is being sabotaged because a cross-section of the ruling party members are calling for her to go. Others from the opposing side are saying she should remain. Some are even threatening to go on naked demonstrations and all that. What do you make of these?
It's unfortunate. We're dealing with an institution that is so important to the stability of our democracy. In fact, it is the factor of our 25 years of democratic stability. So what we've said is that this politicized atmosphere of discussing the institution that is independent and that must be respected for its unique features has to be tempered by due process. The law clearly states what has to be done, except that in this case, it's not just the chair of the commission, but the two deputies as well. Okay, there's a petition, and then there are counter-accusations. And what we are urging we should do is that the president, the Council of State, Parliament, and the Chief Justice, all four leaders of the institutions they head, have constitutional responsibilities towards the EC. And therefore, they should confer on how best an acting or interim chair could be appointed, and how the investigations could be conducted so that it shields that from the politicization, which is not what we need at this time.
Dr. Akwete, some people are saying the ongoing crisis at the leadership of the Electoral Commission is a threat to Ghana's burgeoning democracy, as some people would say. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's a threat if nothing is done, because the election calendar is a tight one. Already in August, the Electoral Commission is supposed to conduct elections at the National Delegates Conference of the ruling party. And there are many more coming. And after that, a possible referendum on constitutional amendments should take place. So it runs a busy schedule, and it has to plan ahead of time. And when you have crisis of leadership, it impacts, it affects the institution, the morale of staff. It polarizes them or divides them, their allegiances. People are afraid and they can't work for productivity. So there's a high risk that they will not be able to perform their regular functions. But in the meantime, the EC has people. It has technocrats, administrators of elections, lawyers and so on, who could do the work even without the three leaders. And we think that if they do that, we will avert the crisis.
Since this crisis unfolded in the eyes of the public in terms of the media, how has been the reaction so far of Ghanaians?
There are those who are serving as voice of reason and say, look, let's do the right thing. There are those who are looking at politics. Either you belong to one of the two parties and you are seeing some political conspiracy in there. But at the end of the day, the conspiracy theories are not as powerful as the counter-accusations that have come from three leaders. Because it's coming from such high leaders of an important institution or reduced to a political conspiracy.
Emmanuel Akwete is Executive Director of the Institute for Democratic Governance. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from Ghana's capital, Accra. Gambia's Interior Minister, Mai Fati, has denied accepting bribes from the Belgian biometric passport and identity card company known as Simlex so that the company can be awarded a Gambian government biometric contract. Pandere Umbai reports.
The minister made the denial on Thursday during a news conference held at his office at the Kanifing Municipal Council locality. Surrounded by service chiefs from the police, the prison, the fire and ambulance services, and anti-narcotic officials, Minister Fati denied receiving bribes from Simlex.
I want to be very clear here. First and foremost, I did not award any contracts. The contract, as I explained, is very clear. It was awarded by the former president of Yahya Jammeh. He cancelled it through an executive directive against the advice of the Ministry of Justice. And when we came over, we followed that same advice of the previous minister, the Minister of Justice under the previous government, and we are seeking to renegotiate the terms. And if anybody who has any evidence to show that I have been bribed, I welcome you from any part of the world to come and show us.
Mr. Fati said the previous contract signed between the former Jammeh government and Simlex was not fair to the government. He said under the past contract, the Gambia government was supposed to get 30% of the monies accrued from the biometric passport and ID card contract, while 70% of the proceeds derived from the contract goes into the pockets of Simlex. Hence, he said the old contract is being renegotiated by the new government. Mr. Fati also defended his recent statement in Parliament that Pristine Gambia Limited was not involved in the production of biometric passports.
The other question is whether I stand by my statement in Parliament. Yes, I stand by that. Pristine was never involved in biometric passport production of any nature. I stand by that statement.
Mr. Fati also says under the circumstances, government has no alternative other than sticking to the previous contract. This rules out the possibilities of companies such as Pristine Gambia to compete with Simlex.
If the question is yes, we make an open tender so that other ministers can, others can come forward. We already have a valid contract on the table. This is our position.
Mr. Fati also went further to back up his claims that the contract between the two parties is still valid.
The signature column is here. It was signed on the 16th of June 2016 by them and on behalf of the Gambia government also on the 16th on the same dates.
He said the investor is a Senegalese national who is working with other parties to introduce a forensic lab in the Gambia. Fati challenged reporters to visit the Ministry of Justice, where he said the company has been incorporated. Mai Fati had this to say to those complaining why the Senegalese national didn't invest in his own country, Senegal.
We are proud that people are coming to invest in the new Gambia, and we will not question them why they are not investing elsewhere.
Fati says under the new deal, the forensic company will enjoy 5 years tax-free regime and will help to train Gambia security officials on forensic research and analysis. For Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, July 28th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The UN Secretary General's Special Envoy for Burundi has called on the Burundian government to engage in an inclusive dialogue with the opposition as a prerequisite for peace and stability in the country. As Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura, Michel Kafando made the call in a speech to the UN Security Council in Geneva.
The United Nations Secretary General's Special Envoy, Michel Kafando, addressed the United Nations Security Council on the current political situation in Burundi after meeting the Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza and other political stakeholders outside the country. He said inclusive dialogue is the only way to restore peace and stability to the country. He says that he encouraged Burundi government to imperatively engage in an inclusive inter-Burundi dialogue. In that manner, the recent visit of President Pierre Nkurunziza to Tanzania, where he met President Magufuli, is encouraging and hopes that the move is an indication of the willing towards an inclusive dialogue. The Burundi government has remained reluctant to sit down with opposition leaders it accused of plotting a failed coup. Alain Diomede Nzeyimana is the deputy spokesman of President Pierre Nkurunziza. He hailed Kafando's report.
In general, he got a positive message. But as far as the inclusive dialogue he's talking about, I wanted to remind that the government has said that there's no way Burundi is going to sit together with people who have committed crime and who were planning a coup against the leaders of Burundi.
The regional mediated dialogue failed to bear fruit because of the government's refusal to participate in the recent rounds of talks that took place in Arusha. Former Burundi President Domitien Ndayizeye said the Burundi government should engage in an inclusive regional mediated dialogue if it is to end the political crisis.
We have negotiated with him while he was fighting against the government. You know, Nkurunziza himself was condemned to death, but we have accepted to negotiate with him. Even if he don't want to negotiate with the people who made the tentative of coup, I know that he has not accepted to meet the other people up to now.
Mr. Ndayizeye said that the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy, Michel Kafando, should pressure the government to engage in an inclusive dialogue.
He has a hope that he will be able to resolve one main problem, which has to convince the government of Burundi to join the inclusive dialogue with the opposition and all political parties in Burundi and civil society.
Meanwhile, as Burundi gradually regains stability, the government's focus is on the 2020 general election. President Nkurunziza formed a commission that will amend the country's constitution in efforts to scrap the term limits to allow the incumbent to contest in the 2020 general elections. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
The Islamist armed group Al-Shabaab burned several homes in raids on villages in Somalia's lower Shabella region in late May of this year, according to the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. The group released a report Thursday that it said is based on eyewitness accounts and satellite imagery analysis. Human Rights Watch says Al-Shabaab fighters abducted civilians, stole livestock, and committed arson in attacks that caused more than 15,000 people to flee their homes. Letitia Bader, senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch, spoke to reporter Mohamed Ola Hassan about the report's findings.
Starting in late May, Al-Shabaab fighters raided about 18 different villages in this very tight-knit community in Lower Shabelle, entered the villages, burnt many of the homes inside, raided and stole livestock, and also abducted dozens of men, including elders, who they then held for several weeks in the Al-Shabaab-controlled town of Mubarak. And many of the individuals that I spoke to when I was in Mogadishu said this was really the last straw. They had been facing drought. They had received threats in the last few months from Al-Shabaab, telling them to leave their villages. But then the burning down of their homes in particular really was the last straw.
What did you base your report?
Well, I basically interviewed many of the people who were directly fleeing these attacks, so who were coming up seeking shelter, seeking protection inside displacement camps in Mogadishu. Now, as you know, there are already tens of thousands of people who've been displaced place in Somalia over the last few months because of the humanitarian crisis. Now, these people have now been coming up into already dire contexts inside these displacement camps. And so I spoke to a number of people who were fleeing directly because of the violence in Mogadishu. And subsequently, I spoke to many others over the phone because the attacks happened for over about 3 or 4 weeks, basically. And so I was speaking to them at different moments to understand how the contexts were unfolding. And at the same time, we basically found satellite imagery from the villages which were the most affected to analyze and assess the scale of the destruction.
Can you describe the impact of the Lower Shabelle clan conflict along with the fight against Al-Shabaab civilians?
Well, I mean, so Al-Shabaab was obviously in control of the whole region until about 2012. And, you know, little by little, there have been AMISOM, the African Union forces, and Somali government forces which have come in and taken some of the towns. Now, the situation has become incredibly tense, especially since 2013, between two clans and clan militia in particular, the Biomal and the Habergibir militia, who have been fighting and have really placed civilians at the center of this fight.
Well, can you tell us whereabouts of the civilians you say in your report have been abducted by Al-Shabaab? Did you get any information back?
Well, dozens of men, civilian men, especially elders, were abducted, especially in the last few weeks of May. Now, several of them were basically taken to Mubarak, which is a town under Al-Shabaab control. They were held in makeshift facilities in those towns. Some were released after negotiations with clan elders. And, you know, those who were released basically described very dire conditions inside these detention facilities, very limited access to water, only being fed once a day. And one man who was arrested actually died of the consequences of an outbreak.
Letitia Bader is senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with reporter Mohamed Ola Hassan of U.S. Somali Service. In a bid to address the acute fuel shortages in South Sudan, President Salva Kiir has appointed a committee and given it 72 hours to crack down on black market fuel dealers in Juba, as well as ensure that the filling stations receive adequate fuel supplies. Michael Atit reports from Juba.
Though the president's 72 hours ultimatum expires, the committee has yet to announce when they will commence the crackdown on the black market fuel sales or explain how it will supply petrol to all of Juba stations. A litre of petrol or diesel costs 22 South Sudanese pounds at filling stations. Hundreds of vehicles across the capital queue for several hours to buy fuel from the few remaining stations that still have fuel. Most of filling stations are closed because they have no fuel to sell. Dozens of people along Juba streets can be seen selling fuel repacked in mineral water bottles and jerrycans. A 1.5-litre bottle of fuel that sold for 100 South Sudanese pounds in the black market 2 weeks ago now costs 700 South Sudanese pounds. A 20-litre jerrycan, which sold for 4,000 South Sudanese pounds, now costs up to 8,000 South Sudanese pounds on the black market. Muhammad Lino Benjamin, Undersecretary for the Petroleum Ministry and a member of the President's Committee, says most filling stations have no fuel because people are stockpiling fuel so they can sell it on the black market. Lino says that is a dangerous business.
These fuel products are very actually flammable, and if caught fire or put in the wrong place, this will also be hazardous.
Lino says cracking down on the black market fuel sellers is just the beginning of the process to address persistent fuel shortages across Juba and other parts of the country.
Now we are addressing the issue of selling the fuel products at the right place. Availing fuel products is also another process that we are working on to make sure that there is fuel available for everyone in the country.
But a Juba resident who prefers to be identified only as Mayan because of the sensitivity of the fuel security in the city, says he buys from the black market to avoid the long queues at the fuel stations. Speaking in Arabic, Mayan says he does not understand why he must spend a day or two queuing up at the congested fuel stations when it is available in the black market.
In spite the negative aspect of the black market, it is still helping many of us as working class who do not have enough time to spend at petrol stations. If they are going to ban the black market, I hope they will also avail fuel in every petrol station so that people are able to get it at shortest time possible.
Mayen says even though he pays an overpriced amount of money for fuel on the black market, he knows he will have fuel to run his private vehicle. Some black market fuel sellers who decline to have their voices recorded for fear of being arrested say they sell fuel on the black market because it is their only source of livelihood. 3 weeks ago, Finance and Economic Planning Minister Stephen Diudau proposed lifting government subsidies on fuel and to allow the market forces of supply and demand to determine the price of fuel. That change has yet to be implemented. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin with the draws on Thursday evening of the inaugural edition of the 2017 West African Football Union Cup of Nations, WAFU, billed for the 9th of September to the 24th of September in Ghana. Host Ghana has been drawn in Group A alongside perennial rivals the Super Eagles of Nigeria, the Gambia, Sierra Leone, Mali, Mauritania, Guinea and Guinea-Bissau. In Group B, Senegal, Liberia, Burkina Faso, Niger Republic, Ivory Coast, Togo, Benin Republic and Cape Verde will make up teams in the group. The winners will remain in the group for the round-robin exercise, which will see the two best teams advance to the semi-final. Reactions have continued to trail some of the critical changes and decisions reached last week by the Confederation of African Football, CAF, in Rabat, Morocco, at the end of its three-day symposium. South African Football Association President Danny Jordan believes that South Africa stands to gain a lot from the expansion of the African Cup of Nations and its reversed dates. For his part, Vice President CAF Kwesi Nyantakyi disagrees with the insinuation that the quality of the African Cup of Nations will drop following the expansion of the number of teams to take part in the competition. And out of volleyball news, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda and Egypt are set to relieve their rivalry in African volleyball when they clash in Nairobi for the Women's Volleyball African Zone 5 qualifiers for the World Championship, which begins this evening. John Marie Nsengwiwa, Rwanda women volleyball coach, says no team should be underrated in the qualifiers. Technical director of the Kenya Volleyball Federation, David Lunguhayo, is confident that the host will emerge winners at the end of the qualifiers. The four teams involved will play in a round-robin format with the best two-ranked side heading to Cameroon, where the winners will secure their ticket to the World Championships. Africa has only two slots for the World Elite Tournament. In basketball news, Tunisia's basketball team on Thursday beat Portugal 70-62 at a friendly in Villarreal, Portugal, as part of preparations for the AfroBasket 2017 to be co-hosted by Tunis and Dakar, Senegal on September the 8th to the 16th. And in handball news, Tunisia's junior handball team were eliminated by Germany 21-27 in the quarterfinal game of the 2017 International Handball Federation Men's Junior World Championship played on Thursday in Algiers. Leading up to the quarterfinals, Tunisia eliminated Iceland 28-27. Tunisia will stay on to play the ranking game for proper placement. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that's it for this Friday, July 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.